This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the mind space in the metaverse where a big subject becomes clear in less than half an hour with the assistance of the top experts. This week, there's a staffing crisis in the NHS. Why is it happening and what can we do about it? A couple of months ago, the Briefing Room took a broad look at the challenges facing the NHS. Today, we want to dig a little deeper into one specific but critical area of difficulty, the recruitment, training, and retention of staff at all levels within the service. Just why does the NHS have a staffing problem, and what can we do to fix it? Step inside the Briefing Room and we'll find out. Joining me first in the Briefing Room to lay down some basic facts is Annabel Collins, Senior Correspondent at the Health Service Journal. Annabel Collins, what is the scale of the current staffing problem in the NHS?
Staffing is the main issue keeping NHS leaders up at night, and it has been for a number of years, even before the COVID pandemic hit. In the English NHS, it's estimated the overall vacancy rate is around 8%, meaning a shortage of over 100,000 staff. And this has remained fairly stable over the last 5 years.
So it's not gone up significantly. It's been at that level for some time.
Yes, absolutely. But it's really important to add, there's no robust data on the level of vacancies in the NHS. The figures above are based on aggregated data, which includes job adverts. And in reality, it's probably much worse. Data from earlier this year pointed to a sharp increase in staff choosing to resign from their jobs. So in the 9 months to January 2022, almost 70,000 NHS staff resigned, which was up from 57,000 2 years before.
Now, which particular jobs in the NHS are most affected by shortages?
So the NHS doesn't have a surplus of any staff group, but some are in more trouble than others. Particular pressure points are community-based roles and mental health and learning disability professionals. For example, over the last decade, the number of learning disability nurses working in England fell by over 40%, health visitors by around 18%, and community nurses by over 10%.
If we were to divide the NHS into two little bits for the moment, those that are close to the community and those that are hospital-based, those that are community-based have seen the biggest shortages.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And the other professionals have fluctuated somewhat over the years. Recently, the government's doing some work to have 50,000 more nurses working in the NHS by 2024. And although the number of nurses overall has increased, it looks broadly positive. When you drill down into the nursing specialties, there are some where it really doesn't look very positive at all, particularly those working in the community.
Sticking to England at the moment, are there any significant variations between different regions of England?
Yes, there are. So the vacancy rate depends on where you are in the country and for different workforce groups. So to give you some examples, in London, it's as high as 11%, but in the northeast, it drops to around 6%. And then when we're looking at the different professional groups, for nurses, it's as high as 10% nationally. And for medics, it's much less at sort of between 5 and 6%.
Now, is the picture broadly similar in the other home nations, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland?
All four countries have NHS workforce shortages and are facing similar challenges when it comes to recruitment and retention. Recent research done by the Nuffield Trust has shown that actually Scotland outperforms England when it comes to the number of doctors and nurses per 100,000 people, but interestingly has a slightly lower vacancy rate. So there are some fluctuations there, but broadly the picture is quite similar.
Is there any hard evidence that these staffing shortages actually put people at risk?
I think there absolutely is. The government is looking into excess deaths in the NHS at the moment. But I think the bottom line is people receive poorer care and there is absolutely an impact on patient safety. I think this was very well illustrated in Donna Rockenden's final report on the maternity scandal at Shrewsbury and Telford Hospitals Trust. It was quite widely reported and raised serious concerns about safe staffing and the impact this was having on care.
Would you say that our staffing shortage problem is primarily about the NHS failing to recruit staff, or primarily about staff leaving in ways that they might not leave other industries where they employ by them?
I think the answer is absolutely both. The leaky bucket analogy is often used when it comes to NHS workforce. There's no point recruiting more people if you can't keep the experienced staff you've got.
Annabel Collins, let's get an idea of why, right now, the NHS is having such problems with recruiting and retaining staff. With me in the briefing room are Alison Leary, Professor of Healthcare and Workforce Modelling at London South Bank University, and Susie Bailey, a Specialist on Healthcare Leadership at the King's Fund. Alison Leary, can we start with recruitment? How do we decide upon the number of people we're going to train to go into the NHS?
The supply of healthcare workers is determined really by the budget. So unlike other safety critical industries where we'd look at demand for labour and different types of labour, the supply in healthcare is determined by how many people we can afford and how many people we can afford to train. And that leaves usually a deficit.
In other words, we're not making a decision based on the number of people that we need. We may not even be making a decision on the basis of the number of people we could afford to employ in the future. We're making a decision based on the number we can afford to train now.
The budget is set by the Treasury, and so that very much determines how many people we can afford. NHS trusts do projections, but they don't project labour needs. So what they'll do is use it based on activity, so how many people have hip replacements. But we think that that kind of projection doesn't reflect the actual need for labour. So the consequence of that is you get lots of people working unpaid overtime.
Oh, I see. So it depresses your understanding of how many people you'd need to train for future jobs.
Yes, unpaid overtime is generally masked in the system. So your average district nurse, for example, will be doing a day a week unpaid overtime.
Now, looking at it from the outside, the obvious question which we always ask is, why don't we just train more medical staff?
The issue that we have is we have a capacity issue, both at universities and in hospitals and clinics. So healthcare training, that's medicine, nursing, physiotherapy, etc., requires at least half of their course normally to be in practice. It's a vocational course. So you need enough staff in practice to be able to train people. So just opening up lots and lots of university places without the people in hospitals and clinics and general practice to be able to support those students won't increase supply.
OK, so Alison, once people do start training to be doctors or nurses, and we have found people to train them, how big a problem is them just simply saying part of the way into the course, nah?
Attrition for these courses is generally higher than a lot of other university courses. So nursing's attrition, I think in 2018, was something like 24% on average. That went up in 2021 to 33%. So one in three people in 2021 on average were leaving the course.
And do we have any idea why?
It's for a number of reasons. One is that they're having a poor experience when they go into the workplace to train. They're not being supported properly to learn. And also they're getting experience of what work will really be like. And it's obviously working conditions now are not great for a lot of people. The other reason is the financial reason. So it's quite a large debt for people to take on. It's very labour intensive. It's very physical. It's very emotionally intensive work.
Susie, why does the NHS start to lose people early or mid-career?
Put simply, the work demands consistently exceed the resources that are available. So staff are working in situations once qualified where there are high levels of vacancies, sickness absence, staff turnover and stress. And so those are having consequences on people's experience at work. It's having consequences for their health. And ultimately, it also affects the quality of care that they're able to deliver. I think it would be important to appreciate that the issues within the NHS were there before the pandemic. So what the pandemic did was shine a particular light on the health and well-being of the staff and where the NHS was falling short in terms of being a good employer. We have an annual staff survey in England. And when you look into that, it echoes many of the things that Alison's talked about in terms of, you know, 57% of staff surveyed, you know, were working additional unpaid hours every week. Less than a third of staff felt there were enough staff for them to do their job. And nearly half of them reported feeling unwell in the last 12 months due to work-related stress. So that's the kind of scale. This isn't just a blip. Some of these rates are the highest they've ever been.
Susie, I just want to be clear. Is having a bad experience at work, as far as we can tell, the main reason people give for leaving?
Unfortunately, the data is still quite limited in terms of reasons for leaving. So, for example, the data for the year March 2020 to March 2021 in terms of people leaving, over half of that, the reasons were unknown. However, there has been some recent analysis of data and people's experience at work, the culture in which they're working is becoming more of an issue for people and people's work-life balance is becoming more of an issue. There are obviously some very specific issues around age, about where people work, around the profession they're working in. And Alison has drawn particular attention to nursing as a particular issue.
Is this bad experience or these series of bad experience partly a managerial problem? And I suppose what I'm asking is, do managers in the NHS manage their staff well?
So I think we have some amazing examples of managers and leaders right across the NHS. And these are clinical leaders as well as managerial leaders who care deeply about giving their staff a good experience and making sure the right conditions are in place. But I think it's fair to say that we don't have a consistently compassionate, inclusive leadership approach. We do see examples, and the survey again shows this, of where staff have a poor experience. There is discrimination, bullying and harassment. So it's really important that we develop the skills and behaviours of line managers and supervisors, because fundamentally, people's relationship to their manager and to their team is a big factor in how you feel at work. So we have to make sure that people have rest, that they have flexibility in the hours they work. We need to make sure that people have access to food and water and the kind of basic human needs when they're at work. But fundamentally, we have to tackle the excessive workloads that people are working under. That's not sustainable.
Alison, we tend to think about the health service as being either hospitals or GPs, but Annabel Collins, talking to us earlier, made the point about other health workers, particularly health workers in the community, and how they are leaving, or there's a particular problem, partially because they tend to be older and therefore they're likely to retire early. Is that what you're seeing too?
It's very much what we're seeing. So we lost around 50% of district nurses in the 8 years before the pandemic. And that means workloads and caseloads are going up. That means the people that are left are having to do more work. People are much sicker. They're much sicker at home with lots of different needs. And that's something that I think isn't really considered when thinking about workforce.
So people who are doing those jobs are leaving in greater numbers. What is the knock-on effect of not having enough of those people? I mean, obviously, the remaining people have to do more work, but presumably the people they were otherwise dealing with end up somewhere else.
They end up in hospital a lot of the time, yeah. And obviously then they can't get out of hospital because those nurses and social care workers are not in the community to look after them.
Now, what about salaries as a factor? We've talked mainly in terms of people's conditions at work and so on and the workload. How important are salaries, let's say, for nurses and community workers, given comparative salaries and conditions elsewhere?
Nurses particularly have always been very tolerant of poor pay. They're also an 89% female profession and women's work tends to be paid less. But what we're seeing is not only rates of pay not keeping up with inflation and the cost of living. I mean, I'm working with about 13 different organisations now that have opened food banks for their staff. We're also seeing a degradation in the rates of pay. So, for example, a few years ago, a ward sister would have been what we call a band seven, which is about, these days, about £40,000 a year. I scraped NHS jobs about 6 months ago, and that is now offering a band six rate of pay for about 50% of those jobs, which is £33,000 a year. And when you consider that if you are in that sort of role, you are looking after a ward 24-7, 24-7 responsibility, a budget of around £250,000, 70 staff, or a massive caseload in the community, that is really undervaluing work.
Now, talking about people who maybe occupy less trained skilled jobs, but nevertheless do important jobs. Are they literally better off going into work in a supermarket, for example, where at least you'd say get a 10% discount on your food?
I think the workers in social care certainly are. There was a really interesting report from the King's Fund. If you are a social care worker on an average hourly pay, you could easily get yourself a 6 or 7% pay rise by going to one of the big retail grocers. Yeah, right now.
Right. OK, yeah. So there's an obvious problem there. Mm. Susie, do staff tend now to retire earlier than they did? And if so, why?
So I think we're definitely seeing trends in terms of the number of staff indicating that they are thinking of retiring early. And we hear frequently from leaders and clinicians right across the service that there's a stronger sense of people wanting to retire early. Pandemic had a particular impact, people just feeling exhausted and, you know, given the backlogs in the NHS, people feeling unable to just continue on at that kind of level.
Let's talk about some of the other things that you could conceivably do, Susie. I mean, how easy would it be to sort out some of the problems of conditions that you were talking about, like whether or not you provide proper facilities for meals and so on? Do we have any examples of places where people actually have implemented slightly different policies and have got an improvement in staff retention as a result?
A couple that I would probably draw attention to would include Northumbria Healthcare, who during the pandemic and prior to the pandemic really prioritised staff experience, really listened to their staff about the things that mattered, and have addressed a number of those in terms of the priorities for staff, including how they care for staff, some care packages. Berkshire Healthcare have done a lot of work around compassionate leadership, so how the culture is at the organisation. So really helping line managers and supervisors with how they relate to their team and how they involve their team in decision making, so that staff have a greater sense of belonging and contribution to making the decisions in their working life. It has helped with their retention, and also they are organisations that have consistently high levels of good care for their patients. So there is a strong correlation between looking after staff and high quality care to patients and communities.
Susie Bailey there with Alison Leary. Finally, I want to know if the NHS has the right strategy or any strategy for staffing, and what an effective strategy would look like. Joining me in the briefing room are Mark Pearson, Deputy Director of Employment, Labour and Social Affairs at the OECD, and Nigel Edwards, Chief Executive of the Nuffield Trust. Nigel Edwards, can we start with a really basic question? Does the NHS in England, we'll come on to some of the others in a moment, does it actually have a long-term staffing plan? And if it doesn't, why doesn't it?
It doesn't have a long-term staffing plan, which is rather surprising given the very significant problems that it's got across lots of different types of its workforce. I think part of the problem is that the Treasury have been quite resistant to the idea of the financial commitments that come along with having a plan. And the NHS has to some extent got out of the habit of the type of long-term planning that's required here, I think.
I don't quite see why this makes sense even from the Treasury's point of view, really. I would have thought that the Treasury would benefit from there being a long-term staffing plan that they could then work towards the funding of or disagree with and say, no, you've got to have less than that.
I'd completely agree with you, but it appears that the Treasury, and we actually do see this in their approach to, say, diagnostic equipment and building new hospitals, are much more concerned about current expenditure control than they are about costs that may accrue in the future. So we save money on not training staff now without considering the fact that if you think training someone is expensive, then you should try having to staff your entire service using locums and temporary staff. There does seem to be this undervaluing of the future and an over-prioritisation of spending in the present.
And what's the position in the other home nations?
I think the other home nations have done a bit of a better job here. Wales has got a 10-year strategy, although I think it probably could be a little bit more detailed. Scotland have done a bit more detailed planning on nursing and on new roles in primary care. I think they haven't focused on retention enough. Northern Ireland has got a 3-year plan, so they are also doing a little bit better. But I think, again, they could be longer term, but all three of them are doing better than England.
So, Nigel, if there isn't a long-term plan in England, and you said there isn't, how is staffing actually being planned for at the moment? I mean, who does it and how do they do it?
People are, of course, organising training programmes, setting the numbers of medical school places and determining how many specialist doctors and nurses to train. But it's not done in a way that's linked to a long-term understanding of what the needs of the service are likely to be. It's very much done on a what you might call an operational basis. None of it's joined together. There is a lot of short-term action. There's a great deal of planning in silos.
Mark, do other European countries of comparable wealth, do they organise their staffing differently to this? Do they have long-term plans and do they train more doctors and nurses or fewer?
Well, the UK does stand out internationally as being particularly problematic because we've underinvested in training workers for so very long. I mean, today we'd need roughly 60,000 more doctors to match the European average and between 100,000 and 250,000 more nurses. And in particular sectors, of course, things are even worse. So there's a recent Health Foundation report that suggested by 2030, we'll only have 3/4 of the GPs that we need. And for sure, some countries do it much better. And the Netherlands is a star performer. It has an independent body, properly funded, which comes up with authoritative suggestions to government on training needs. And France publishes official projections so everyone can see if their policies make sense. And I think these sorts of approaches do make a difference.
Just to be clear, is the consequence of this planning that they do actually train more people in time to be ready for the jobs when they're needed?
Well, not necessarily. Ultimately, it does come down to a political decision, but it's a question of whether that political decision to train enough doctors and nurses is based on transparent evidence or if it's just a number that's plucked from the air that nobody really understands whether it's part of a long-term plan or not. So I think the Netherlands does very well in training enough doctors. France has a few more problems. It's tried to save money by training fewer than in its projections said it would need. And so there's still a political process behind all this.
Right. So when you hear the constant refrain which you get from government, which is we are now training X more than ever before and so on, what underlying truth does that kind of statement cover up?
Yeah, well, there is some evidence that training's gone up. And in fact, you know, proportionally, the UK has actually been training more doctors than in France or Germany recently. And the number of doctors has increased by about 23,000 doctors between 2015 and 2020. But you're starting from such a low base. Even if this rate of growth is maintained, it would be 15 years before the UK hit the current EU average level. So it is a worry that the government's anyway just been announcing that it's going to be capping the number of new medical graduates again down to a lower number than during the pandemic. So nowhere near enough to close the gap with other countries without huge reliance on immigrant workers.
Now, Nigel, of course, the other way in which we have dealt with this situation historically is to bring in a lot of people from abroad to staff up the NHS. Is finding such staff now harder than it was?
It's going to be a lot harder to staff the NHS with overseas staff for a number of reasons. First of all, there is a global shortage of health professionals, and the other Anglophone countries are busy shopping in the same markets that the UK is, and often pay more and offer more attractive jobs in sometimes less hostile environments. So we're not that well placed. There's other issues that quite a few of the jobs do require you to have some really good understanding, not just of medicine, because we can get some excellent medical graduates, nursing graduates from overseas, but for, say, for general practice or for being a geriatrician, and actually understanding the society you're in, the cultural norms of the patients that you're working with, makes it additionally challenging. And that means that shopping for those staff in other countries is also particularly difficult. We're not at the top end of pay rates anyway for the Anglosphere, by which I mean the high-income countries where English is the first language.
Mark, would you agree that there is going to be, or there is now, a global shortage of health staff?
Very much not going to be. Very much there already is this huge global shortage of health staff. Even within Europe, the UK is not the only country with staffing problems in their health service. There's huge problems in France, Italy, Spain. They're all going to be competing for staff. And if you think globally, one of the big things that's going to happen in the next decade is that India finally is talking about spending more on its health system, and it badly needs to. It's a very underdeveloped health system. That means there's going to be massive demand for health workers from India. India, it's such a huge country. And of course, it's been the main source of many health workers in the UK. And even in other countries that have been sources of health workers in the past, the Philippines is now feeling much more nervous about training so many nurses who then subsequently emigrate to the UK and other countries. So it's going to cut down, apparently, the number of nurses that will be training.
I'm going to ask you both this question, which is, given from what you're saying that the problem of recruiting staff from abroad is going to be great, and there is going to be a lag anyway, even if you did all the planning that you needed to do for the future, is there a way of saving on the number of staff we need by, for example, the better use of technology? Mark first.
Yeah, I very much do think this. Now, let me be clear, not in the short term. In the short term, there's no way around this. We need more doctors. We need more nurses. But in the longer term, we are very stuck into thinking about doctors and nurses. But really, why? Why do we spend 10 years training doctors to be experts in everything, only for most of them then to specialize in just one small area of the body? Do we really need to go down that route? I mean, health is pretty much the only area where categories of workers have remained essentially unchanged since about 1860, despite such huge changes in technology and health needs. Now, I do think new technologies, your smartwatches, phones, other wearables, online diagnostic tools, give us the opportunity to think about whether other sorts of workers can help deliver health services. Maybe with data analysts, with advanced practice nurses, with doctors of nursing practice who don't take so long to train, but who can do some of the things we routinely rely on doctors to do, such as triage, deciding who actually needs to see a doctor, or monitoring the development of diseases that have already been diagnosed.
Nigel, do you agree that there might be some ways of the kind that Mark has been discussing in the longer term for dealing with future labour shortages? And if you do, aren't they subject to exactly the same problems of long-term planning and investment that staffing is?
I'm slightly less optimistic, I think, than Mark. I think there are definitely opportunities for technology to help to supplement the workforce and to perhaps take some of the administrative and other burdens off staff. There are some promising developments using image recognition software, which can speed up and improve the productivity of staff. There are some caring tasks which are hard to replace with technology. But I think you've put your finger on a very important problem, which is not only are we an outlier in our failure to invest in the workforce, but I think Mark will confirm that the UK is also a significant outlier in how little we have been spending on technology and capital investment more generally.
Mark?
Yes, I can confirm that.
Mark and Nigel, I'm going to ask you that last unfair question you always get asked. If there was one thing you could do to improve the situation for staff recruitment, what would it be? Nigel?
A lot of the focus has been on planning and recruitment, but actually a great deal more effort needs to be going into understanding why people are leaving and the problems with retention. Across the world, there is an issue with burnout. There is a particular issue post-pandemic of people really having had a very tough time. So we should focus on keeping the people we've got. There has been a bit of a tendency to do workforce planning a little bit like First World War generals, which is very high rates of attrition and then just bringing some new recruits behind. And that is no longer tenable for all of the reasons that we've been discussing.
Mark Pearson, what do you think?
I'm going to agree with Nigel, but from a slightly different angle. I think the quality of the working environment, especially in England, is one of the barriers to recruitment. The reason why people are maybe reluctant to go into the health system, sure, more pay would help. I'm not against that. I don't think, compared with other countries, the UK is particularly badly paid, but sure, paying more will help. But where it does stand out is that it's not seen as actually a very pleasant place to work in the health service. And so thinking about the quality of the working environment, how people can actually contribute something so that they actually feel that they're doing good rather than fighting against the system that isn't giving them the resources they need, I think would help enormously with recruitment.
Mark Pearson there with Nigel Edwards. And my conclusion to that is, well, stop me if you've heard this one before, long-term problems need long-term solutions. My thanks to Annabel Collins, Alison Leary, Susie Bailey, to Mark Pearson and Nigel Edwards. We'll be back next week. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Kirstine Knight, Bob Howard and Simon Watts. The studio manager was Rod Farker and the editor was Tara McDermott. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can tune in to the one about how to fix Britain's dirty rivers, an episode about who's winning the war in Ukraine, and one on the economy where we looked at the best policy to deal with the energy cost catastrophe.
I'm Gus Casely-Hayford. As a historian, I love to unpick the hidden histories behind what we wear. In my series Torn for BBC Radio 4, we hear about the fashion items that have changed the world. From the humble tote bag...
I have a textile dating from late 17th century, and it is quite like a modern tote bag with a beautiful pattern of crisscross and flowers and just two elongated handles.
To the miniskirt.
There were other possibilities in the air, and the miniskirt was the beginning of saying we are somebody different.
That's Torn from BBC Radio 4. Listen to stories that are woven into the fashion items in your wardrobe. Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.